So we're recording today's work to turn our workshop back over to Chuck.
Thank you. Chuck, I'm an alcoholic.
Chuck.
So we're on page 68, 69 of the book. We're going into the sex inventory here. Because of the economy of time, I'm going to have to kind of rush through a little bit here. The one thing he does early on before he starts is he lets us know that we're not going to be the arbiter. We're not going to judge anybody for any sex problems they have. Very clear. He's very clear on that. He says we all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them? So we're not taking a position here. We've got everybody in the room in AA. We got the people who have sex only in the missionary position to procreate, which to have children. We have those guys, and then we have the ones that you don't want to leave your poodle in the room with. The trisexuals will try anything, right? So we don't care. Not our business. We don't care. We're going to have some guidelines we're going to follow, but we're not going to get involved in the arbiter of anyone's conduct. We're going to look at where it causes harm. And the question was always, well, why do we have that in here? Well, I mean, why is that part of the inventory? I mean, what's the deal? And it's such a powerful emotion. It's such a driving force. It's part of our own DNA. It's part of who we are. And what I have found is if I get a phone call in the middle of the night, because my phone doesn't ring late at night usually. If somebody calls in the middle of the night, it's usually because of this. It's usually a relationship problem or a behavior, or sometimes it's money. It's either sex or checks. Money or honey. That's pretty much it. So that's why it's important. And it drives it. What it does is it has the ability to really gut me. It reaches in and every deficiency that I have, it opens up. It has the ability to really size me down and make me just... It's the thing that makes me want to put a gun in my mouth when it's not going right. You know, and there's nothing more painful than going through a breakup. You know, there's nothing more painful when acting out in behavior and being sorry for it over and over again. Regarding this particular part. So the book says on 69, we reviewed our conduct over the years past. Who wants to read that?
I'll read.
Thank you.
We reviewed our own conduct over the years past. Where have we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Whom have we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. In this way, we try to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subjected each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? We ask God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. We remembered always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, either to be used lightly or selfishly, or to be despised and loathed. Whatever our deal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends where we have done harm, provided that we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answers will come if we want it.
We'll stop right there. Anything? Questions? Comments, guys? Anything at all? So there, oh, please,
hey, Jim. So we're all not perfect in sex, and is that kind of say kind of like resentment? Everybody has problems.
It says we all have problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. It's there. We all have got problems. There's an insecurity here that will come up. There's the drive that's there. I'm the guy. Remember, I'm dealing with thousands of years of evolution. You know, these are natural defects of character and stuff. Natural desires gonna arrive. It's like my drinking. It's off the charts. And it can happen in other places in my life. This is one of them that it can happen. And it says here that I'm supposed to look over my conduct. Where have I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking? Or inconsiderate, rather. Whom did I hurt? Did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where was I at fault? I got this all down on paper. Look at it. The dishonesty in this area is like so hard to see, because when you meet somebody, isn't it true that if I feel that way about somebody, isn't it true that I'm going to put my best foot forward? Aren't they going to see the best parts of me? Aren't I going to act better than I really am? Not knowing that I'm really doing it when I'm doing it. And that's the dishonesty is rife, and the jealousy, suspicion, the insecurity. I'll give you an example. This is about, if you're a woman, please don't throw your book at me, because I've had someone almost do that before. Some years ago, I was with my wife. She wasn't my wife then, and we were shopping, and we were having one of those days where you're just kind of, you're with the person you're with, but you're not getting along very well. It's whatever. It's just, you know, you're out with her today, you know, just like that. And so, you know, we had a couple little arguments or whatever, and we go to the mall, and I'm in a bad mood. I'm not happy. I ain't smiling. I'm just kind of going through it. We're at the mall, and we're walking along, and I see this girl from a meeting who's a lot younger. And she's pretty. She walks up, and out of the blue, I go, "Hey, how are you?" And all of a sudden, Mr. Nice Guy comes out, and I give her a hug, and we start talking. And hey, how's it going? I haven't seen you in a while. And my wife's standing there, and I'm not going, "Hey, this is so and so." I'm just carrying on here, just going on and on and on. And she walks away, and you can see you later. Give her a hug, and she walks away. And my wife goes, "Who's that?" And I said, "Just one of the girls. Just one of the girls. Just, you better watch out, because they're lining up. You better act right. I didn't even know I was doing it. I didn't even know I was doing it until she started to get upset, and then I saw what I had done. I saw what I was arousing, jealousy and suspicion because of my own insecurity." Years ago, a bunch of us were going to a gym and work out, and some of the guys didn't show up. One of the girls showed out. We worked out. I came home, and she was livid. I said, "Yeah, Richard didn't show up, so-and-so, but so-and-so showed up." "Well, you and her were working out?" I go, "We're in a gym." Boom! She flipped. And she's not jealous, but she got psycho on me. She was like calling me and accusing me, and I had to go to a meeting that night and do something, and I'm on the way, and she's calling me at the break, and you know, I remember that time that you guys had lunch, and she's been around for a while. This is funky. She's just go, and I'm like going, "What are you?" And the more you try to defend yourself, the worse you look. And anyway, I didn't know what to do. I got home, and she was in bed, and blah, blah. And the next day, I came home, and I thought, this isn't going well. And she came home, and this is what she did. Now, she doesn't have a sponsor. She ain't working a program. She's not part of AA. None of that at all. This is a rational reaction that people have that are normal. She said to me, well, I came from Channel 4. She goes, "Can I talk to you?" I go, "Yeah." "You're going to bite my head off?" She said, "No. I'm really sorry for what I did the last 2 days." And I said, "Really?" She said, "Yeah. You know what it was I'm getting older, and I've gained weight, and I don't feel very good about myself. And I took it out on you. And I had no right to behave like that to you, you know. I know that's your friend. I know there's nothing going on there." And I thought, "Will you sponsor me?" But, so I got to look at this. Where have I been selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate? Whom did I hurt? Did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness in them or in me? And I got to look for that, because when I'm starting to wonder about what you're doing, I'm arousing suspicion and jealousy in myself, and it's not okay. It's not okay. It will run the gamut on me. Where am I at fault? What should I have done instead? I got this all down on paper and look at it, and I write it in front of me. Where am I at fault? What could I have done instead? I subject each relation to the test. Is it selfish or not? Where am I being selfish? And then it says, I ask God to mold my ideals and help me live up to them. And sometimes I write ideals out that I have for myself and for the other party. Sometimes I write down what it is I'm looking for. Because see, when I get to Alcoholics Anonymous, my entire life, it's about partying, getting loaded, having fun, doing stuff with people, whatever it is. And I don't think too much. This is kind of how the interview goes when I meet someone in a bar if she's pretty. Here's the interview. Do you get high? End of interview. Not, do you have a job? Do you have a job? Do you work hard? Are you honest? Are you decent? Are you a kind person? Are you a manipulator? Who cares about any of that? Let's just get to the deal here. Let's get to what I want, right? Yeah. And so, you know, I don't have these ideals. So when I write the ideals that I start looking for, this is what I found amazing was I started writing out ideals. Somebody who's honest, somebody who's kind, who's self-supporting, somebody who, you know, who values me, somebody who is pretty. I started listing this stuff. And what was a trip for me was I was with the same woman for a long time when I looked at that and went, oh my God, how did God in his ultimate wisdom put that right in front of me? How did that? And when I sponsor a guy and he's got the ideal lists when he's in a relationship and if he's having problems, I'll ask him, how close are we on the ideals? If you got a few of them and you can work, that's great. But if I'm missing the boat on all of them, hey pal, the numbers are there. The numbers are there. Do I want a fixer-upper? This is not a good DIY project, you know. Clint Hodges used to talk about relationship and arrangement. Relationship and arrangement, and they're different. An arrangement, I keep score. I did this, you owe me that. You do this, I do that. That is an arrangement. A relationship, Clint used to say, is a covenant for growth. It's a covenant for growth. And it starts, I think this helps a lot to look at what I'm doing, how I'm doing it, how I'm reacting, and it doesn't mean every time that there's a part of, like there was an act that took place. The inventories that I've written are really, they're like stuff I've done where I'm not doing anything wrong, but I'm acting not married. I'm being too friendly with people in a way that isn't okay. I haven't done anything wrong. I haven't tried to make time with the person, but my behavior and where my mind's going ain't cool. And if I start to write this out and do the prayers and all that on it, I'm less likely to go that direction. And it says here that we make amends quickly if we've done harm. Now, obviously, you know, if it happened years ago and the person's married, I don't need to go screwing up that. That's in the amends portion. I don't get involved in that. Not a good idea. But where I'm causing harm now, and I've had guys come to me and say, you know, I really blew it. This happened the other night, and I really feel terrible. I can't sleep. I can't look her in the eye. And I'm like, oh my God. Why don't you write the inventory on it? Write the inventory on it, sit down. And they go, what do I do? Do I tell her? And I go, I don't know what you do. I don't know what you do. Would it harm her to tell her? And what do you want to do now? What do you want to do? Do you really want that relationship more than anything? Yeah. Or do you want to continue carrying on doing this kind of stuff and probably drinking again? No. But I don't think I want to be with her anymore. Well, then let's pray on that for a while. Let's take that to God. And if that's the answer, then why don't you get away from that? Maybe you don't have to say what you did, but get away and go live your life. And if you're sorry for what you did, let's stop the behavior right now, be on page, and let's treat her the way she's supposed to be treated. Let's cherish her. Let's ask God to help see all the good in her and to see not the bad, because I focus on something and it just blows up. So the answer is, you know, it said here that we do it in meditation. We ask God what we should do about each specific matter. And every time I finish the inventory on anything, I've been lucky. My sponsor is great. He'll always say, okay, now go take that to the big shooter. Go take it to the big shooter. Go take it to the guy who's going to help. Now go to prayer about it. So here it says God alone can judge our sex situation. Counsel with others is desirable, but we let God be the final judge. We realize some people are as fanatical about sex as others are loose. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice. I think the principle is I don't want to cause harm. I want to reduce any harm that's going on. I don't know what the answer is in every case. I don't have a clue. I just know what we've done in the past with people and how it's worked out. I've seen people who've made a mistake and cleaned it up and not gone that direction again. I've seen people who made a mistake, continue to make the mistake, and ended up paying a price for it. I've seen that go down more than once. And then we have this line, suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and stumble. Does that mean we're going to get drunk? Some people tell us so. It's only a half-truth. It depends on us and our motives. If we are sorry for what we have done and have the honest desire to have God take us to better things, we will have been forgiven and learned our lesson. If we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. Not good. We're not theorizing. These are facts out of our experience. So, there it is. I think it really comes down to that part right there. If my conduct is harming others, I'm quite sure to drink. I've seen people in Alcoholics Anonymous that their conduct harms others. They don't seem to drink, but they are miserable and awful to be around. Miserable and awful to be around. And it's not good. It's not. I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be that guy. I don't think anybody I'm around wants to be that guy, really, when it comes down to it. And then it says here, to sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for the sanity and the strength. So I'm asking for that. I don't have it. To do the right thing. If sex is troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. There's that again. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourself. It quiets the imperious urge when to yield mean heartache. So we don't have a step in Alcoholics Anonymous for a broken heart. We don't have a step for that. We do have a suggestion. Go help somebody else. Go help somebody else. Go get somebody new. Go help somebody so I can get out of this thing because I'm in a trap and it's spinning and spinning and spinning. I just told you what Bob said a minute ago. You know, somebody who's in a relationship problem, they ain't thinking about nothing else. That's all it is. Every conversation. Anybody sponsor someone like that? Every conversation is what he or she's not doing. Over and they'll tell the same story. Oh, you're like, you just told me this yesterday, dude. And the day before. But it happens over and over. And I need to pray for the right ideal and the strength and the sanity to do the right thing here. Whether it's cut it off, make it work, whatever it is. We don't have an answer for you. But I do know that I need to treat this like I treat the resentments. I need to take it to God and do something about it. If I don't, my conduct will continue to harm others. And we'll be back to that. Remember that drinking thing, that little problem way back there? So in the sex portion of the inventory, we have those questions. We reviewed our conduct. Were we selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate? Where did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? What could we do instead? We subjected each relation to the test, whether it's selfish or not. We asked God. And then whatever our idols turn out to be, we're willing to make amends and to move on. And am I willing to have God to grow toward the right ideal and realize that this isn't dirty? It's not some seedy, you know, Van Nuys Boulevard porn shop thing. It's not a dirty. It's God given. It's God given and good. It's part of who we are. It's the way that I take it. When I attach power to it, it becomes lust. When I attach power to any natural instinct, it becomes something else. The power is what perverts it. And I have a hard time with that barometer on how to not screw things up. It's like the drinking. I overdo it. I overshoot the mark. So on page 70, it says, if we've been thorough about our personal inventory, we've written down a lot. We've listed and analyzed our resentments. We've begun to comprehend their futility and fatality. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. We've begun to learn tolerance, patience, goodwill toward all men, even our enemies, for we look on them as sick people. Remember that? We've listed the people we hurt by our conduct and are willing to straighten out the past if we can. I was probably 16 years sober, doing a thing. We were reading the book. And the dude said to me, I said, yeah, we have resentment, fear of sexual misconduct. He said, what about the harms done? I go, what are you talking about? He goes, what about the harms done? I go, well, that comes in 8 and 9. We take it out. He goes, read it again. And I read it again and I went, we have a list of people who we've harmed by our conduct. So, there's one more list. So, I know I'm going to pull people from resentment, fear, sex, misconduct, but I also am going to have other people that I need, that for me, the guys I sponsor, I have them write down harms done that have nothing to do with this. Maybe they don't have any fear about it. Maybe it doesn't bother, but write it down. Let's write it down now, because we're going to, when we go to step 8, it's going to tell us we have a list, we made it, and we took inventory. Did I make it or did I not? So it's there. So it says here, in this book, you read it again and again, that faith did for us what we couldn't do for ourselves. We hope you're convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from Him. If you've made a decision and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, you've made a good beginning. It's a beginning. It's a beginning. And I can't emphasize enough. We were just talking at the break about this, because oftentimes we'll do an inventory, or I have, and I've gotten some freedom from that. The view's changed. Many times it will not change until I go to make my amends. It won't change until I start really doing the work behind it so I can really see it up close, front and personal. And that is in the amends process if that happens. So this is the start, and then I have some other steps to take. So I'm going to read this to a sponsor. I'll tell you how I read my inventory real quickly. My sponsor took me to a restaurant. We sat down. We were eating dinner. And he looked across the table at me, and he said, So, this is out of the literature. He said, so, there's something you've done in your life, or a couple things that you don't like yourself for. You don't like even thinking about them. They fundamentally have changed you as a man and as a human being. What are they? This isn't going good. Just out of the blue, I went like, he goes, what are they? And I started to talk about some things. They weren't even on the list. I started talking about some things. And he looked at me and he said, yeah, I know. And started telling me about himself. And what he did for me, unbeknownst to me, was a kind, kind thing. He allowed me the ability to make this, after I'd gotten that out of the way, I could talk about anything. And we started this process. We went to his house and finished up the reading. And the book tells me that I'm to find a closed mouth, understanding friend who will not change my course of action here. In California, most of us now read to our sponsors. When the book was written, I have to remember that it was written really to be mailed out. And it wasn't like today where you throw a rock in L.A., it lands at a meeting. You just, go like that and it lands at a... There's 2,700 meetings a week in Los Angeles. I mean, and it's like, it's crazy. You almost don't have to work a spiritual way of life or anything. You don't have to work the traditions. You can just keep going from meeting to meeting to meeting to meeting. I mean, think about that. Before AA was grown like this, if there was a meeting a week in your town, how did you stay sober? Prayed a lot. You got a power in your life. You had to. It was forced. You had to. You couldn't just hide from yourself and hang out in meetings. I mean, meetings are great, but that's... Or if you live in a small town, you've got to practice traditions in your life. If you don't practice them in your group, you won't go. In Los Angeles, you don't have to do that. You can throw the traditions on the back burner and go from place to place to place. You can. I watch people do it. Yeah. It's awful. I wish we had time for the traditions. I love the traditions. So I got a list. I've got the stuff here. I'm going to go to the promises and the fifth step, which are on page 75. Would somebody read those for us on 75? We pocket our pride.
We pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twisted character, every dark cranny of the past. Once we have taken the step, if only nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone in perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the Spirit of Jesus.
Let's stop right there. Anybody relate to that at all? Anybody? Anybody want to comment on that? We pocket our pride. We illuminate. We light up every dark corner of the past. Once I've done this with holding nothing, I can look the world in the eye. I don't know about you, but for a long time when I was here, I had a tough time looking in your eye and shaking your hand. It was really, really awkward. And it started to change. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. I remember this guy, Sponsi's got 11 months now, and I remember we read this and he went, dude, that'll never happen for me. You don't know how my head is. It doesn't stop. It's like a home entertainment center with everything but an off button. You know? It's just... And I said, well, we'll do the work and we'll figure it out. He said, I don't believe you. I don't believe it's going to happen. I said, that's okay. Let's just do the work. So, and this starts to happen. I do this and all of a sudden it quiets down. I may have had certain beliefs, but I'm beginning to have a spiritual experience. The feeling the brick problem has disappeared will come strongly. I know this happened for me. My first inventory, which was the weird, was that booklet thing. I rode home that day with some relief and I didn't feel like drinking that night, but that was it. When I did the inventory with my sponsor out of this book, with this work, I remember getting on the 15 freeway, the 95 freeway in Las Vegas, and I was driving back. I was tired, really tired and washed out. It was a long talk. And I remember looking up, and I had never seen the Vegas Strip look so bright. It's like they'd turned up the volume on the lights, you know, and I just felt this peace. And I went back to the place I was staying, and I sat in the room alone for 1 hour and reviewed the work. Sat there quietly, and I did what he told me to do. He said, look at the first five proposals. Ask yourself if you've left anything out. If you have, you can call me back. And I've had guys do that. I have them call me and say, I forgot to tell you about this. And then he said, after you've done that, turn the page and do steps 6 and 7. And on top of page 76, if we can answer to our satisfaction, we then look at step 6. We've emphasized willingness being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove all the things from us which we admitted are objectionable? Can he take them all, every one? If I still cling to something and I won't let go, I ask God to be willing. There's a prayer. There's a prayer. The 6-step prayer. God, help me be willing. Our friend Jim Buckley. Do you remember him? Jim Buckley, I love Jim. Jim used to call this, Jim's the guy that used, he coined the phrase, ready, fire, aim. Which is how I live my life. Ready, fire, oh, aim. Jim used to call, he used to call this the Judas step. And I love that. Step 6, the Judas step. And the reason he called it the Judas steps, he said that the master, the carpenter man, had 12 disciples and one of them turned on him. And he said, this is usually the step. There's always a step that I'm going to take back or I'm not going to do that's going to take me out. And this is the one, he said, is common. And I've come to believe that because this is where I start. This is my unwillingness kicks in after a while. And I'm no longer willing to do things. I start finding myself not being willing to be honest, not being willing to do a lot here. I find myself slowly slipping into that because sobriety starts with two words. It starts with, please help. And it ends with two words or three words. I got this. I got this. I don't need to call my sponsor about that. I don't need to tell anybody that I did that. I don't need to make that right. Don't you know who I am? I got a boat to pay for. I can't go to that job. I can't go to that meeting. I can't help those newcomers. I'm too busy. I watch the fruits and benefits of sobriety. I watch the great blessing that God gave me. I watch the trappings, the prizes, and the cash. I watch that be the noose that I hang myself with. Watch. Keep your eyes open in AA. Watch. I've done it myself. I've been right at the edge of that where everything else is more important. It just starts. That's the way life is. It just kind of, if I don't keep my eye on the ball, the untrained eye, people around you tell you, why are you doing all that work? Haven't you done enough around there? And then I got the kind of head that I'll go to the meeting and do my commitment and be driving home and my head will start talking and say, didn't you do this for that guy? Didn't you set that up? Does anybody ever tell you thank you? It just starts. So this is the point where if I see stuff that I'm not, because I had problems with this. I'm a salesman. I run a business now, but I used to be on the phones. And you want me to be honest? Really? What's going to happen to me? What if I really want God to remove my lust? What if that really takes place? What would that look like? Well, they have Viagra for that now, but, you know. But do I really want it taken away? What I don't, it's like the drinking. Because this is kind of a trip. I thought about this a while back. If I'm here trying to get sober, in some weird way, rudimentary, I'm kind of doing a six on it, even though I haven't done one yet, because I really want to stop. I really don't want to stop. I want to stop, right? And I really don't want to stop drinking. Come on, really? What booze does for me? Do I want that to stop? No. I want the firing at work, the fights, the losing relationships, the hangovers. I want all that to end, but I like the drinking part. Bill talks about the 12 and 12, the root and branch. I want the branch, I just don't like it sticking me in the eye. Right? So at this point, I'm getting to a place where I want to ask to be willing. And maybe I'm not totally willing. Pop, can you help me be willing? Can you help me be willing to lose this? Can you help me with this? It's an important step. This is the one that over and over that I battle with, because I always, my mind will tell me that I should be doing other things than going to meetings. And I mean, come on, really? You got to retire sometime, guy. I mean, it's, it just starts, you know. So this is the part here where I want to say this prayer. I want to realize this is the growing up step, as he calls it in the 12 and 12. And I have to realize something else, that the only step that we're going to do 100% is one. Everything else here are ideals we're trying to shoot for. But the only one we're going to get right is one. You're never going to get more than human. Not going to happen. Not least in this life that I know of. On 76, when ready, here we come. We say something like this: My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and to my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. We've now completed step 7. So there's an amen there. It wasn't on 3. I don't know why that is. Some people say it's because it's a continuum. I don't know. But it's there. It's a nice prayer. Anybody want to comment on the prayer? Anybody? Anything? Anybody? Okay. I am willing you should have all of me, good and bad. I never thought I could take the bad part of me. Yeah, please.
Remove from me every single defect of character. And you talked about we were going to meet with our sponsor and let it all out from all the inventories that we took on fear, sex, and resentments, right? Mm-hmm. So we come to a general understanding that I have a lot of problems. I'm not perfect. And then the defects of character are kind of like you made it very simple that you just sit down face to face and you just say, well, this is who I am, I guess. And it opens it up to that.
This is who I am not. And what I'm going to do now is I'm going to take the defects list that I have, the things that are blocking me, and I'm going to become willing to have God take those.
Okay.
And then I'm going to ask in this prayer to do that. I'm asking for every defect of character that stands in the way of my usefulness to him and to my fellows, that they be removed. And it's a prayer that I say over and over and over and keep looking at the list and keep asking for the help. And sometimes, like, for instance, sometimes, you know, right away. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Oh, I just wanted to comment on it.
Yeah, go ahead.
Amen.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to say about the prayer you were talking about, six. So, you know, when, for me, my experience with that is when I'm looking at that objectionable behavior inventory or the defect, getting to 7 and really asking God to, you know, for me to be willing to remove everything, the good and the bad.
Yeah.
At this point, what I'm really seeing is that I don't have any idea of what the good and the bad is that I work like. I don't know what that is. I see certain things as objectionable,
But I have to be open to the idea that God is actually going to use whatever He sees fit to use in me. Mm-hmm. I may feel those things are objectionable, but He may use those things to be helpful to others. Mm-hmm. So I feel like that prayer really opens me up to a whole new way of looking at it and being willing to get rid of all of that stuff. What I see as good and what I see as bad.
Mm-hmm.
And so just really being in a position where my higher power is then going to enable me to be who He wants me to be. Now that I've gone through inventory, seeing this objectionable behavior, and now I'm in a position where, you know, I have this willingness. It doesn't mean that I'm going to have to pray for the willingness if I'm not ready, which it talks about a little later after the prayer.
Mm-hmm.
I just have to be willing.
Absolutely. Thank you.
The first two in that paragraph, I used to think that step seven was just a prayer. And I think we missed the two words that start that paragraph off, which are when ready. I got to know what when ready means. When ready means to me is seeing that, taking the first six steps and seeing all the objectionable behavior. Because I can say a prayer, but if it's not from a place of sincerity,
yeah,
there's nothing worse than playing, saying a prayer that you don't need. But if I come to this place and I'm entirely ready to turn to God for help with all these things, so I think this is a pivotal part in the process where I go from living from a place of complete powerlessness to now living a life with power. And I got to know what it means that I'm going to be willing to turn to God for help with all these things that I've seen are objections. Right? Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things that we find objection? And that isn't something that I just do one time. I mean, steps 6 and 7 are going to, steps 10 and 11 are going to be an extension of steps 6 and 7.
Yeah.
You know, 6 is about me watching for objectionable behavior, or 10 is about me watching for the objectionable behavior. Mm-hmm. It's about turning to God for help with it.
Yep.
And 7 is about me turning to God for help with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So I got to be committed. Like, am I really wanting to make this commitment to a sincere place? And I think that's why we humbly ask.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So what are the main ingredients that I got to have in order to humbly turn to God in step 7? And I think that the first 6 steps have to be vital.
Yeah.
It's not
absolutely.
I can just, you know, it's just work on praying until it translates into a journey.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Willingness and humility are right here. And this humbly asking business. I'll tell you a story that I have with this. Because if you read the 12 and 12, the 6 and 7 are really expanded upon in that part of the literature. But what happened to me was this. I was working in a business. And I'm a high school dropout. I got this job working with these guys. And they were making a lot of money. And they trained me and I got good at it. And I started making a lot of money quick. I mean, a lot of money. I'd never seen this kind of money before, and I was hooked. I was in. And a few weeks into this, I don't know, a couple months into it, I'm working late one day, and one of the guys is laughing about this. I'm so serious about it. I'm wearing a coat and tie to work with a briefcase, and I've got all my stuff set up, and they're kind of like doing whatever they want to do, all these guys. And the guy's laughing at me, like, you think this is real? And I went, what? And he opened up the book and he started showing me the legals, and it's like a scam. I mean, it's like there's people are putting retirement money in, and like a percentage is going to this thing, and all the money is going to the owners. And I went, and here comes the justification and rationalization of a guy like me. I twisted that around and made it okay. Somehow I'll help a lot of new guys. I'll do this. I'll do that. Maybe it'll work. Maybe it could work still. It's a great idea because it was a great concept that we were working on. And I told myself this. It was a great concept. It was kind of a template of what eBay is today, but it never happened. So I'm starting to make more money, and I'm telling myself it's okay. It's okay. It's okay. I'm having trouble in meetings, like I said earlier. I can't listen because I'm a liar and a thief. I hate myself. And I get to this portion, and my sponsor says, well, listen, what are the defects of character? Why don't you... He didn't say quit the job tomorrow. He said, take it to God and pray. So this is what I did. And I started asking earnestly for help because I hated the way I felt. This is what happened to me. It's not like I went one day and go, oh, I'm not going to do it anymore. No. I went every day and did what I was supposed to do and was doing what I do and I'm good at it. And I could not sell anything, which was like, where's this coming from? I can't close a deal. Now I'm going through all my money all the savings is going away, and I keep holding on, holding on, holding on. I can't close a deal. Now I'm borrowing money from the boss. I'm getting advances, and I can't see what's going on. And one day, I'm in my desk. This is the truth. I'm closing a deal that will solve all the problems I have, and it's all going down. This is all happening. I'm going to be out of the jackpot. And I'm in the middle of the docks with the guy on the phone, and I hear this noise from behind me, and I look up, and I got agents with 9mm going, "Drop the phone, a-hole." And I'm doing this, FBI agents everywhere. The building's full of people from Department of Corporations, the IRS, the Postal Service, L.A. County Sheriff's Department, LAPD, you name it, they're the alphabets, they're all there. And, yeah, this ain't good. This ain't good, man. And anyway, I tell you something, that defect got removed. And I'll tell you how it got removed. It got removed because I ended up going to, they were after the owners and stuff, but I ended up going to trial and having to testify and stand in that box in the federal court in San Diego, which was no fun. And watched a lot of people go away for a long time. And I admitted the truth. I went in there and told the truth. And what took place for me was this. If you would have called me up and said, "Hey, look, we got some Alaska oil deal going on. We got guys pulling up on the RTD bus, and 2 weeks later they're driving Porsches," I would get a sick feeling in my stomach. I would feel repulsed by it. There was nothing in it. The goodie, the cookie in it was gone. It was gone. And I didn't do that. And I think when we do this sincerely, because it's the cookie is what I want in it, the goodie in it. And when the goodie's removed, the behavior stops. And if I go and ask, like I said earlier, I think sometimes God really pays more attention to this and is more serious about it than sometimes I am. So, great work. We have the list. And, you know, we're not going to get very much into this, but I'm going to, the amends itself, I'm going to take the list. And what I have done with the amends is, I have the guys take the harms done, resentments, and I have them break it into 4 different sheets. And we have, or Clint Hodges used to use 3x5 cards, which are great. And here's what we do. We first of all put down, I'm willing and I'm able now. I'm not willing, but I'm able. I'm willing, but not able. And I'm not willing, and I ain't able. And we start working on the ones that we're ready to do. And we start knocking them out. And as we do them, I find myself moving to the next column, and the next column, and the next column. And then I get to the point where I'm praying for willingness and opportunity and see what flushes out. And over time, they've popped up out of the blue. I will tell you, what I did the first time I did the steps was I did the amends that were going to bite me. The ones that are going to bite you are family support, IRS. They're going to get their money. So I was a good AA and called them up and made arrangements. Everything else I kind of like sidestepped, you know, said sorry to some people, moved on, I'm changing, and did that little game. And, you know, and then later on I'm doing this scam business, and later on I want to kill myself, and later on, and I get to the inventory, finishes up, and Bob's waiting for me to do these amends, and I got stories. Don't you know? I got reasons why I haven't done this or that. And I'm sitting with him one day, and he looks at me, and he goes, "Yeah, I know guys like you." Because I sponsor a guy like you. He's 20 years sober. He's a mess. He's always doing, he's a smart talker. You know, he's like you. He's wheeler and dealer. He makes money for a while, and then he's broke. And then he's back again, and he's broke. He's always chasing the deal. One of these days, he'll blow his brains out from the way he's acting, you know, because he's unwilling to make his amends. He said, I also got this other kid over here, you know, so-and-so. I go, "Yeah." He goes, "He's not very bright. He's a good guy, though. He does his step work. He makes $8 an hour as a plumbing assistant, and he gives his wife all of his extra money. Lives in a sober living. Doesn't wear nice clothes. Makes sure his kids are taken care of." He said, "What's going to happen for him is he's going to get promoted, become a journeyman. He'll make a little more money. He'll get a new truck, buy himself a little place to live, take care of his kids. And he'll build a business. A few years, he'll have 4 or 5 trucks. He'll be living in a beautiful home, clear and free. And you, my friend, will be doing what you've always been doing." and I knew he was telling me the truth. He said, the universe is the greatest accountant there is, and it keeps track. And if I owe, I will always owe. And he said, but if you give back, you'll be surprised at what God will give you. He'll give you the kingdom. And I thought, Bob, you know how far in debt I am? He said, I don't care about the money. It's time to start. Here's what I want you to do. And he made it clear. And I started doing that stuff. God, I was $30,000 in credit card debt when I had no money coming in. It was bad for a while. And I did what he told me to do. I did not want to do it. There came a point where I couldn't pay anybody. And I had to call them all and say, I don't have your money. I know you have to sue me. If I move, I will let you know where I'm at. I will call you. I'll notify you. Because it says in the literature that I'm afraid to face my creditors. I'm quite sure to drink. It says it in here. And I had to go back and do that. And it took me a few years to do it. But here's the ironic thing is everybody that I know has had these problems. Remember Harvey? Harvey Glass. He died, so we can say his name. This guy, Harvey, well, we can say his last name because he's dead. Harvey came into Alcoholics Anonymous and he owed $2 million and he paid it all back and lived a good life. Because see, I don't get it, but as I start to pay, I start to make more money. As I start to pay, more opportunities come up because the universe can trust me with this. As I start to pay, I feel where I belong. I start to get right. As I start to go visit people that I've hurt. As I start to put back the relationships that I've torn. This is about mending the tear in the fabric of the relationships. Because if you're like me, I don't know if you're like me, but I'll be driving down the road, left a meeting, everyone says what a great guy, and all of a sudden my head starts attacking me. And it starts bringing up files of stuff I don't like about me. And I haven't done amends, and it'll work me. But after I've done amends, we have the other attorney to defend me to go, wait a second, you paid the money back. Wait a second, I've been visiting that kid every week for the last, wait a second, I was there for his graduation. Wait a second, all of a sudden it starts to happen. Wait a second, I was there when they were sick. Wait a second, I showed up and I played son that time. Wait a second, and I can counter it. Otherwise, it will always, always wear on me. And I will know the truth about me. I will know the truth about me. All those things I don't like about me and I'm afraid of, they're real. Because I haven't taken care of business. And when I've taken care of business, look, if I act better than I am, I'm going to end up being better than I am. They say act as if. They say don't fake it till you make it, I don't like. Act as if is okay. Because if I act as if today and tomorrow and the next day, I become. If I clean up all this stuff, pay the money back, make the things right, write the letters, do whatever it is I have to do, I start to turn into a cut cloth guy. And then I experience the promises of the ninth step. I know in meetings people just read them off as if you sit in a chair and all this beautiful stuff happens. If you're sitting in the chair wondering why that ain't happening for me, ask yourself, have you made everything right yet? And I'm just asking. My friend Chris R. in Texas says, people say they say they're recovering alcoholic. And he says, why don't you hurry up and finish your effing amends so you can become recovered. Recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body with a purpose to carry this message, to practice these principles in all my affairs. So I can then become a guy that practices 10 and 11 and it has something to show someone else to recover. So I can shine the light and show somebody else what I'm doing. Want some? Come get some. Jack, want some? Come get some. And I can be part of the ringside seat to the greatest show on earth, to watch people recover, to watch scummy, low-down, homeless, worthless, thieving, lying, stealing wretches turn into guys who pay their taxes and raise their kids and buy homes and see their parents and help other people. When you watch somebody who's hopeless walk in with a new guy, when you watch him walking with him and you see the light in his eye because he's connected with something. Something happened in all that action where he could see and love something in that guy that he can't see and love in himself. There's a guy in Colorado who died a few years ago. His name was Don Pritz. Wonderful man. Don said it best about step 12. We don't have time to go into it. Forgive me. Don said, my contribution to life is to show another man his contribution to life. Wow. It's been a long day. We're about done on the time here. I want to thank you for sitting and listening to me all day. I feel sorry for you. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.